From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, and welcome to this week's edition of Naps Chat. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. Over the past number of years, partisan disagreements, whether they be on policy or political philosophy, have become toxic and corrosive to our democracy. As we have discussed on this podcast, the Postal Service has become ensnared in these disputes, resulting in unwarranted attacks on its employees and on the institution itself. This week's guest on Naps Chat is former Congressman Tom Davis, who served a number of years and in a number of capacities that deal with our topic today. He was able to navigate partisanship and work collaboratively with those who may not have shared his political stripes. Welcome to Naps Chat, Tom.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
For our listeners, permit me to share a bit of your background. Congressman Tom Davis served in the House of Representatives for 14 years, culminating with a four-year tenure as chairman of the House Committee on Government Reform. His committee conducted considerable legislative and oversight work relating to the Postal Service. In addition, prior to holding the position as chairman of the Government Reform Committee, Representative Davis served as chairman of the National Republican Congressional Campaign Committee. Within that capacity, which is not exactly the most bipartisan position, he provided tremendous counsel, not only to members of his own party, but he provided critical political intelligence to anyone who would bother to ask him. And after his departure from Congress, which was completely voluntary, he did not lose an election, he has provided counsel to numerous organizations and companies during his post-congressional career. Again, welcome to Naps Chat, Tom. And I'd like to ask you, start off with one question, and we'll take it from there. You know, I talked about the toxic political environment in Washington that leached out to many parts of this country. You were and continue to be a respected and admired legislator, despite being a partisan. How did you accomplish this feat, and how would you counsel new members of Congress to be productive and constructive legislators?
Well, I think there's a time to campaign and a time to govern. They're two completely different skill sets, and a lot of members are good at getting elected, but they're not very good at governing. I came from local government, where I was chairman of the county board in Fairfax, and prior to that, a member, 15 years in local government. It just teaches you that at the end of the day, you got to keep the streets swept. You know, you got to keep the garbage picked up. You got to fill potholes. That was where you were result-oriented. And so I really came out of that environment where every 4 years we'd fight for 2 months, but after that, donkeys and elephants disappeared. It was a different time also. Today, the parties are ideologically sorted. We've had three macro factors that have affected politics over the last 20 years that have caused this polarization. The first is what I call the advent of single-party districts, where now the vast majority of members of in both houses, the only race that counts is the primary election. So to get reelected, they have to be favored by their primary voters, who are a thin ideological slice of the electoral pie. So for Democrats, they stay left. They vote left. That's who their rhetoric is. And for the Republicans, it's on the right. Secondly, the media models today are really not about information. They're about affirmation. And people tune in every night to get their local fix and get their worldviews validated. So we walk around in different bubbles. In my day, we dealt with the same facts. Now everybody's got their own set of facts. And then finally, the money in politics has moved these super PACs away from the parties, which are enforcement mechanisms in primaries for anybody who dares get away from the party line. So I think these factors have really led, if you will, to the collapse of the middle in American politics, and basically rewards bad behavior and punishes compromise.
You know, let me pick up on that. During your years in Congress, one of those issues where we were able to work together was the issue of postal. And my folks are very involved in postal legislation and things that help the Postal Service, bills that help the Postal Service. And they, as I said, they were primarily bipartisan. When you chaired the Government Reform Committee, President Bush released the results of a bipartisan commission on the future of the Postal Service. I think that was early in your chairmanship. You and former Congressman John McHugh worked with your successor, Representative Henry Waxman, and Representative Danny Davis, who went on to chair a subcommittee on postal issues, you did not always agree on the policy, but you effectively collaborated on legislation. On a micro level, with regard to postal legislation, how was that accomplished?
Well, first of all, I was lucky to have as my ranking member, Henry Waxman, who came from a different political universe than I did. He came from a very liberal district in Los Angeles on the West Side, but he was in politics for the right reasons. And I found out when we talked about really what was good for the country, you could bring this discussion to where we could try to meet in the middle and try to fix things as opposed to just going back and blaming the other person. So much of politics today is red jerseys versus blue jerseys. It's how do we beat the other guy? And, you know, we all have that tendency. And Henry and I sometimes knew we had to quarrel and go back to our conferences and show we were beating up the other guy. But at the end of the day, we never lost sight of the reasons we were there. And that was to make lives better for the American people.
Now, another issue which breached partisan divide during your tenure was the support of your committee, which was, you know, clearly at the time of when you were chairman, there was a Republican in the White House, there's a Republican majority in the House of Representatives, and your subcommittee chairs, John McHugh, chaired the Postal Subcommittee, and as I said, former Congresswoman Connie Morella chaired the Subcommittee on Civil Service, and you all collaboratively fought for and on behalf of federal employees and retirees. I don't recall any of you or your committee colleagues ever attacking the public service as it's being attacked currently. Has the federal service become so politically charged?
Well, actually, there were always instances in both parties where the federal service was attacked. I can remember Bill Clinton, one of his big lines at the Democratic convention when he's running for reelection is there are fewer federal employees today than when I took office. And if you took a look at some of his policies at this point, it was moving out certain functions away from government out into the private sector. You take a look at sequestration, which really hurt federal employees. That came under the Obama administration. It was an Obama administration kind of initiative. So I think it's really gone to both parties, sometimes driven by the exigencies of the moment, where you've had budget pressures. But oftentimes, if you don't represent a lot of federal employees or don't believe you can, they're just a great person to be able to attack because they can't answer back. And it's always these nameless, faceless bureaucrats and not the people who made the policy that they're carrying out that's easy to attack. So, you know, if you can attack an opponent and they can't bite back, that's an easy mark when things aren't going well. I think both parties have been able to find that, in some instances to be the way to go. Today, also, I just always recognize that good and bad didn't rely exclusively with one party. I always said if you don't have a high tolerance for hypocrisy, then you probably shouldn't get into politics because there's a lot of hypocrisy on both sides, depending, you know, what is needed at a given time and what you want to tell voters. I tried to step back from that and just try to recognize there's good in both parties. They both represent perspectives and constituencies that deserve a seat at the table. How do we get a problem solved? And again, that comes back to my experience in local government.
Yeah, what I was referring to was on the committee. The committee never was the venue for this attack on federal employees or the federal workforce.
And no, not at all. I think one of the reasons was because you had people like Connie Morella and myself and others who represented a lot of federal employees, and it would have been counterproductive to do that. Secondly, is that the major focus of this committee has not been federal employees. It's really, since the Republicans combined them in 1995, it's been investigations. So the committee is investigations. It is federal employees. It's also government contractors. You know, it's got different jurisdictions around there. But they've always found the investigatory side to be better, to be sexier than going after federal employees.
Let me ask you this question. I just popped up. Would it make sense to split up the committee again? That is, maybe have a House committee on investigations, then a House committee on the postal and federal workforce, or something along those lines?
Well, it was combined in 1995 when the Republicans were trying to consolidate some committees. and just show that they were going to be more efficient about this. So you had the old Merchant Marine and Fisheries Committee was combined with another committees, and they took what was then the Government Operations Committee and added the DC Committee and the Post Office and Civil Service Committee and made it into one committee. These areas were, by the way, not really, I would say, priorities for a Republican Congress, so they felt that they didn't need to have their own sounding boards, their own seat at the table. And I think that was part of the reason behind this. But also, you know, within the committee structure, they were trying to show some consolidation, fiscal prudence, and they saved hundreds of staff positions by doing that. You could make the argument, should you go back to it, I think sometimes what happens in these committees is they become so captive by the people they're supposed to legislate about that they lose any level of objectivity. For example, the Government Operations Committee was put together because the Ag Committee got really close to Big Ag, the Defense Committees, you know, Armed Services Committee got really close to the Pentagon. And so when there were problems, they didn't tend to investigate. They tried to gloss them over. So this committee was created to be able to have a free hand in those kind of things.
Okay, let's pivot a bit. And I'm going to go to an area that both you and I love, and that is, let's talk about politics. Because in addition to your command of the legislative process, you continue to be heralded as one of the keener observers of electoral politics. As chair of the NRCC, the National Republican Campaign Committee, you always provided honest and credible information regarding an upcoming election and handicapping contests. So I'm going to ask you, how do you read the 2020 election, the results, which will probably still be a mystery on November 4th, the day after the election, and how things are playing out?
Well, I think at this point, look, we're 2 weeks out, and by the time this hits, it's going to be like a week and a half out at this point. Trump needs a really good debate to change the trajectory of this election, already with the tens of millions of people voting. I've never seen anybody step on their message as much as he does. I think had he had a little more discipline, he's got a lot to talk about in terms of his achievements over the last 4 years. But because of the way he presents it and the fact that he will go after somebody or attack somebody or go, as you say, off message, this has not been able to penetrate. And he's come across as a bully and not a very nice guy to a lot of Americans who made this a personality contest and not an issue contest. So given that, he's still running a close race. It could still turn around. But instead of making this a choice between his vision for the future and Biden's vision for the future, frankly, that is an election he could win. He's made it about Joe Biden and himself and who's more likable. And Joe Biden has won that. Coming into this, I think he's jeopardizing not only his own election, but the Senate election.
Yeah, that's where I was about to turn to. How do you see the Senate and the House races, like for majority of the two houses?
I think they go the way of the presidential race. I think if Trump wins, the Republicans hold the Senate. If he loses, it's much more difficult. Possible. But we see less ticket splitting than at any time in history. I can go down each race and handicap them for you. But the other thing to remember is the Democrats have a lot more money going into this at all levels, and that makes a difference in close races down the stretch.
Now, another issue about this election, which is fairly unique in that is in a large way, was impacted by the coronavirus, and that is the importance of absentee ballots and what role the Postal Service will play in the effective and efficient conduct of the election, including the presidential election as well as congressional races. Now, the Postal Service has been processing and delivering the ballots right now, and it's come under scrutiny by the president and his assertions, allegations of voting fraud and disruptive actions that potentially were made by the Postmaster General when he came on board. Do you think this will make a difference? How do you see the Postal Service's role?
I do think we're seeing more people voting early in person than would have ordinarily gone to the mail. What's really happened is, because of the COVID environment, more and more people don't want to go to the polls on election day, and they'd like to be able to cast their vote safely and earlier. Mail is the preferred mode of that, and in some states, this is de rigueur. It happens all the time. Colorado and Oregon are mail-in ballot states. That's the only way you can vote. But in a number of other states, as they have tried to move to this, they're really not equipped to handle it. And the voters who are voting are not equipped to vote. So in many cases, they're putting the wrong thing in the wrong envelope. They're not signing it, doing things like that, and having their votes disqualified. Not because of any fault of the post office, but just in terms, they're not used to doing this, and the system is not used to absorbing this. For an example, in Carolyn Maloney, who's the chairman of the committee in the House, over 30,000 absentee ballots were disqualified in her congressional district in the Democratic primary, and she won by 3,800 votes. I think that kind of says it all, that people aren't equipped to this. So the real problem isn't the post office. It's just the fact Americans aren't used to doing this. I also part company with a lot of the mainstream media. Mail-in ballots, it's easier for fraud ballots, and I think you get more with mail-in ballots because you get what I call harvesting the ballots. People go around and pick them up, sign things, turn them in. In some states, it's legal. In some states, it's not. But you do avoid the voter ID issue, that you have a voter ID requirement in some states. And with mail-in ballots, that is somewhat relaxed. And in some cases, it doesn't exist at all. So that is an invitation, if you will, to harvest ballots and if not cheat, at least take advantage of the situation and circumvent the usual rules and regulations, which is the reason I think Republicans feel, are not great proponents of the mail-in ballot.
Although in certain states, the Republican Party has been very effective in using vote by mail.
Absolutely.
Florida and Pennsylvania historically have been strong.
Yeah, my argument is if you don't like it, you just got to learn the system the Democrats have used, where they go out and harvest these ballots. In fact, Republicans won a congressional district in the 25th district of California and flipped the Democratic seat. It was just virtually all mail-in because the Democrats couldn't go door to door and harvest the ballot.
The attacks on the Postal Service that are coming primarily from the White House, and we see this in a lot of the media reporting, not necessarily mainstream media reporting, but just reporting about Postal Service and the election. Do you think this is going to have an impact on public confidence on the United States Postal Service? Because historically, the Postal Service is polled pretty well by the American public.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think we have to get, we've got to get through this election. And there are always going to be some ballots that don't get through in time. And you hold somebody accountable, and somebody, if they lose an election, they don't like to blame themselves. So you look at a third party, and the postal system is sitting out there. So you'll get some of this. But I think by and large, the public has a high confidence in the postal service, particularly during this COVID environment, where they have really, I think, done a really good job of delivering mail in an environment where people are afraid to leave their houses.
Okay, let's synthesize the Postal Service and the election, bring them together. How do you think the outcome of the election, who wins and who loses, will impact the future of the United States Postal Service?
Well, look, as we know, the Postal Service has been in trouble for some time. Ever since, I would say, the Great Recession in 2008, 2009, when mail volume continued to decrease and the like, it's been running deficits. It's got an outdated business model. You take a look at what faxes and emails have done to general correspondence, the changes in law that allow these to displace the mail service in many cases. And the Postal Service really needs to revisit that. They need to decide what flexibility they're going to have to compete. But they're competing against companies that don't want to give them additional flexibility because you're moving into their areas. That's the UPSs and FedExes and some of these other areas. Instead of facing up to this and Congress trying to tackle this issue, they just put their heads in the sand. That's not just Republicans. That's Republicans and Democratic administrations and trying to blame the other party. Really, for the Postal Service to survive, they're going to have to be able to get into some other areas that are profitable because they are, I don't mean this in a negative way, but they're stuck with first-class mail, which is, I think, on balance, a financial loser. It's very difficult to make that a profit center. When you have to deliver mail, a letter that goes for cents on the dollar and deliver this to remote areas. That's their charge. They do this. But they've got to be able to make up for that in other areas. And some of the areas that they could get into, they face heavy competition from the private sector that doesn't want to let them in there. The other problems that they have is, looking at their workforce, they are limited in some of the changes they can make to their workforce by law. And so, that makes it difficult. In a perfect world, you would sit across the table and you say, how do we solve this with the Postal Service and the American public first in mind? But that isn't how Washington works. The way Washington works is all of these different interest groups get put into the put into the mix, and it makes it very, very difficult where any one of these groups can organize and stop any legislation.
So the outcome of the election, will it make a difference or will it not make a difference? Or it'll just play it. The postal economics will be the determinant is how the Postal Service will weather the storms.
I think if you get a unified electorate, a unified Congress, House, Senate, presidency in one area, if somebody's got the guts to take it on, I think they could make it go. But so far, we didn't see this in the Obama administration. And we haven't seen this in the Trump administration where anybody wants to move ahead and do anything but bash the Postal Service.
So the outcome is we're just going to have to wait and see how it plays out.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to wait and see. I think you have to wait. I mean, that's exactly right. I don't know anybody that's running on a platform. We're going to reform the Postal Service. And if you do, how do you reform it? Because if the Postal Service expands, its business lines, it's getting into somebody's shoes. If they let people go, they're going to offend some other group. And so what everybody's done is they just let it alone.
Okay. My final question to you, Tom, is a little known position that you held in Congress was you chaired a select committee that did a postmortem of the government's attempt at relief of Katrina in preparation for Hurricane Katrina, which hit Louisiana and the Gulf Coast during the Bush administration, the presidency of George W. Bush. And you took a leading role in that investigation.
Right.
If you were chairman of a select committee looking at the government's preparedness for the COVID-19 pandemic, how would you go about chairing that investigation?
Well, first of all, you've got to make these things bipartisan, where nobody is trying to put this to the political advantage. You can really get down and take a look at what happened and why, as opposed to pinning this on this decision or not. Look, this pandemic was kind of a first impression. A lot of mistakes were made, not just in the United States, across the world, starting in China, with how do you face this? What are the scientific facts? Things are all over the lot. Good people made decisions that over the course of this turned out to be wrong, but they did them in earnestness. But instead, everybody's just pointing the fingers, trying to put the blame on the other person and use this to their disadvantage. If you put a commission together like that, it's not going to have any credibility. You've got to have a broad-based commission, not just your health folks, by the way, because this isn't just a health issue. This is an economic issue as well. You could shut things down. We could keep everybody at home and send them checks. And you could probably beat this virus, but there's a lot of other bad things flow from that. So I don't know what the right balance is. That's part of the whole political equation, but you've got to make it broad-based. So with my Katrina investigation, the Democrats right after Katrina called for an investigation because it looked like we can pin this on George W. Bush. He screwed this thing up. We can pin this on him. And they called for an investigation, but when we named a bipartisan commission, they immediately started to boycott it. They didn't have subpoena power. They named me the chairman, and Pelosi said, we're going to boycott this. I immediately sent a letter to every Democrat along the Gulf Coast whose district had been affected, inviting them to participate in this. By the way, sent it to their local newspapers and kind of dared them to say, you don't want to investigate this? And many of them came and joined the committee. They said, look, we have an obligation to our constituents over what the Democratic leadership wants. Henry Waxman tried to persuade Nancy. He said, look, we can run this fairly, but she was already out on a limb. But his staff helped us staff this from a Democratic perspective so that we had their perspectives at the table. And we proceeded to hold hearings. We proceeded as best we could to keep this from becoming a circus. We held the administration accountable where we felt they needed to be accountable. We subpoenaed administration officials to come in and state officials to come in and experts to come in and talk about it. We wrote a very lengthy report, which was, I think, wildly heralded as a solid, solid report. We got a unanimous vote even from the Democrats on the commission. And when the White House complained to me about, Tom, you were Republican campaign chairman, what are you doing? I just said, look, this is my job. My job is to identify what went wrong so it doesn't happen again. It wasn't just President Bush. This was a inability of the governor to talk to the mayor and everybody to coordinate. There are a lot of lessons to be learned here so this doesn't happen again. And I found out that when you pursue these things in earnestness, as opposed from a partisan nature, you can get a lot further. It's still hard because the mistrust between the parties has grown exponentially even since I left Congress. It has always been there. But for people who want to be earnest and do this thing the right way and are willing to bend a little bit, we can still do these things. We don't have to walk away and make everything a partisan food fight.
Congressman, that'll be the final word, and the word is let's be earnest. I want to thank former Congressman Tom Davis for joining us today on Naps Chat. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks. My pleasure.
To our listeners, if you enjoy Naps Chat, please leave a positive review in the Apple Podcast Store. And more important, tell your friends to download our podcast and listen in. Be well and safe until next week.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter and make me